Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Greetings, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Patty James, Vice Chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and Chair of this program. It's now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Paul D. Blanc, M.D., MSPH, who is a professor of medicine and holds the Endowed Chair in Occupational Environmental Medicine at the University of San Francisco, where he has been on faculty since 1988. He received his bachelor's degree from Goddard College in Plainfield, Vermont, where he first became interested in health and the environment, later training at the Harvard School of Public Health in industrial hygiene, the Albert Einstein School of Medicine, and the Cook County Hospital in a joint occupational medicine and internal medicine residency. He was a Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholar at UCSF from 1985 to 1987 and a Fulbright Senior Research Scholar at the Ben-Gurion University of Negev in 1987 to 1988. He has been a resident scholar at the Rockefeller Bellagio Center in Bellagio, Italy, and the Academy, American Academy in Rome. In 2011, he was elected as a fellow of the Collegium Ramazzini, an international honorific society of occupational health leaders. He has authored numerous scholarly publications in his field and is also the author of How Everyday Products Make People Sick, as well as today's book, Fake Silk, The Hidden Story of a Workplace Tragedy. Welcome, Dr. Blanc.
So I want to jump right into it. Let's see if this works. No, I'm going to do it this way. Yeah, this is the main character in our story today. It's an elegant little chemical called carbon disulfide, which was first synthesized in the 18th century and later only characterized in the 19th century because its chemical formula was so strange to the people working with it. And in its first decades of existence, it was only as a kind of fancy experimental chemical. And this is, in fact, an early diagram of how it was made, appearing in a British medical journal. One of the people working on it was a man named Jacob Berzelius, one of the founders of modern chemistry, in fact. But it took off as an early industrial chemical, not in rayon, but first in the rubber industry, where it was used not in big, large-scale manufacturing, but in small, little objects that were rubber that was then dipped in a solution of carbon disulfide. This is an example of the large rubber factories, Charles McIntosh and Company in Britain. That's not where carbon disulfide was used by and large. It was used to make these little objects, some of which you'll recognize as modern things, like the shower cap, perhaps, or the chest expanders, but some of which will seem a little strange, like an invalid's cushion or this baby jumper that you see at the side there. And very soon after its introduction, it was recognized that there was a problem with carbon disulfide. This is in the 1850s we're talking about, because it caused mental derangement in the people that were heavily exposed, as well as loss of sensation of the peripheral nerves. And by the 1880s, the term carbon disulfide hysteria was coined. And some of you may be familiar with the concept of hysteria that was developed by Charcot in France. And in general, in fact, almost all of the sufferers of typical hysteria were women, and that's where it got its name. But in fact, there was a subset of men who became hysterical, but they were all intoxicated with various chemicals, chief among them carbon disulfide. The other thing in this slide that you see is a large scientific report by a man named Delpech, who really was the leader of reporting and describing illness in the carbon disulfide workers. And that was in 1856 already that he reported quite a number of patients and described the syndrome very well. It wasn't much used in America, but here's the earliest American medical report from the 1890s. And I want to read you part of it that's really quite remarkable. I have delayed publishing these cases for some years, thinking that I might hear of other similar ones, or that I might acquire more information from the owners of the factory, or from doctors in attendance upon their employees. But it is astonishing what a large amount of ignorance and secretiveness develops among the authorities connected with any factory when questions arise as to the unhealthful conditions under which the operatives pursue their vocation. And in fact, Dr. Peterson only became aware that the patients he was treating had all been exposed to carbon disulfide when their insanity abated enough for them to say what they did for a living. And it turned out he had three patients in a row that all came from the same little factory, which is more than just a coincidence. This takes us up to the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century, when rayon was invented. There were several methods for using rayon. I know a lot of you may think that rayon was something that started in World War II, but in fact it goes back way before then. It's the first synthetic textile, really. And although there's more than one way to make it, the viscose process is what became dominant. And viscose can't be done without this chemical carbon disulfide. This is the process for making carbon disulfide. It's for making carbon disulfide-based viscose. It's really kind of simple. You take some source of cellulose. Usually it's wood pulp, but it could even be grass. It could be the remnants of cotton manufacturing. You put it into a bath of caustic, let it soak for a while, and then you add carbon disulfide. If you don't add carbon disulfide, you can't make the rayon. You let it sit. That's called xanthation because it turns kind of yellow. It's like, I like to say, it's kind of like a toxic maple syrup of a sort. And you then force it down through tubing into a sprinkler underneath a bath of sulfuric acid. And when this fine, thick fluid emerges into the sulfuric acid, it coagulates into the threads of cellulose. And in fact, it's pure cellulose. There's no carbon disulfide anymore, but that's the problem. The carbon disulfide bubbles up out into the atmosphere that the workers are working in. And you can use the same method to make other things that I'm going to come back to. Here's an early carbon disulfide-based rayon factory owned by Courtauld's. This is in Coventry, England, where their ground zero really was. I should just say that part of this project, I became kind of a postcard collector of rayon factories. And if any of you are so inclined, you can find a lot of industrial photographs on eBay as postcards. Apparently, people were very proud of their industries. And so every small town that had an industry had a postcard of its factory. The first artificial silk, which is what rayon was called, poisoning cases were documented, at least, in 1904 in a factory just outside of Philadelphia. And by 1913, four more cases were documented in a different factory halfway around the world outside of Moscow. And despite the fact that the industry was based in the United Kingdom and France, Italy, and Germany, there were no cases whatsoever reported from there. Is that because I think there are no cases occurring? No, I think it's because at the periphery of the industry, people were not, the medical providers were not as much under the thumb of the industry. And in fact, there were no other cases reported for more than a decade. This is a nice little pamphlet from the Metropolitan Insurance Company, which was busy insuring the new rayon industry. Nice Art Deco cover. I've read this little pamphlet cover to cover. There's not one word about the occupational health risks of this industry, although there's some stuff about fire hazard. In 1925, artificial silk got renamed rayon. It got renamed rayon by the American Dry Goods Association. So it was very intentional marketing of the material because rayon sounded very modern, kind of a little bit like radon. So all very sexy. And in 1925, the same year, the first cases since those original cases in 1904 were reported, not in a medical journal, but in the New York State Department of Labor bulletin. In Italy, in the same year, multiple other cases were reported. In 1927, there was a French doctoral thesis. And in 1928, a big presentation at an international conference. So you can't, after 1928, at least professionally, you can't say that people didn't know this was a problem. And in fact, even by 1925, the British Inspectorate of Factories was talking about it. And here's some exchange from the Houses of Parliament, where they would have question and answer period, as many of you know. And Sir William Joynson Hicks, who was the Home Secretary and thus in charge of occupational health, was asked about problems in the artificial silk factory. He says, "I have received reports by the medical and other inspectors of factories who have been visiting these works. It appears from these reports that the conditions generally are satisfactory, but cases of conjunctivitis have occurred at one or two works, and there have also been some cases of dermatitis." So he's saying, a little eye irritation, a little skin irritation. In fact, he knew very well that there was already a case of insanity in one of the factories, but he basically was delivering the kind of political information that we've become quite used to in our own day, I would say. In the 1930s, the rayon industry was characterized by interlocking directorates of various corporations. Really was the first version of the multinational corporation. And also, the other thing that's notable is throughout the economic depression in the 1930s, rayon was going gangbusters. This is a diagram of the interlocking directorates of these various companies. And a key to note here is that England, the biggest players, what biggest player was Courtauld's. I don't know if you've been to the Courtauld's Gallery in London. I mean, his money built a nice museum. But in fact, it's based on rayon. And Courtauld's owned as an entire subsidiary, wasn't publicly owned, the biggest company in the United States that made rayon, which was called the American Viscose Company. Although DuPont was the second player. And I'll come back to that. But they were interlocked with Glanstoff in Great Britain and SNIA in Italy. And so everything was intertwined. When I was working on this book, and Sherry is in the back row, was with me in Stanford when I did some of this work, there was one day when I went back to this book that had this figure that was called Labor and Silk. It's part of a series of books, Labor in London, Labor in Lumber, Labor in Auto, Labor in Silk. They were all put out by the publishing company of the American Communist Party. It's kind of like the all about books of the Communist Party. And this diagram, I wanted to know who actually did the figure for the book. And it was, as you see in the slide, Esther Schimitz. And Esther Schimitz, I looked her up on the internet, because now you have the internet, you can look at these things. She went on to marry Whittaker Chambers. So everything is sort of interconnected with everything when it comes to rayon. Here is, just to underscore how international this industry was, here's one of the big factories in Borås in Sweden, not connected and not even really appearing in that figure. And this is a diagram of the logarithmic growth of the rayon industry over the period of the 30s, because you see that scale on one side of this is not is exponential almost. And in fact, Japan, which is the little open squares, increases to overtake briefly the United States and then fall back. The United States is the highest producer, but that's all British-owned production, or half of it is British-owned production. And that's Courtauld's. As I mentioned, they were dominant in the United States in a duopoly. Instead of a monopoly, it was a duopoly with DuPont, interlinked, of course, on the continent with SNIA and Glanstoff. Here's the Courtauld's plant in England by the late 1930s. This is already in Wales. They had moved their main production site. They kept Coventry, but North Wales was where the big producers were. There's another technological change that happened. And in fact, in occupational disease, often it's the technology that drives the disease. And in rayon, instead of the long, thin threads that you could think of as in any kind of textile, they developed a system of cutting up the threads into little short pieces. And this was quite advantageous because you could then mix them with other fibers like cotton and then weave that, or you could make it into non-woven fabrics that kind of look like felt. And rayon staple became a dominant part of the market. Unfortunately, when you make rayon staple, what you do is you produce those threads coming out of the little nozzles in the bath of sulfuric acid. You pull them together into a tow, it's called, and then you chop it up into little pieces, send that down a conveyor belt. And what happens is that thread cut into pieces dripping with carbon disulfide exposes all the people down the line. So, in fact, the exposure is even higher with staple. And this was combined in the 1930s, of course, with the political repression that meant that workers had much less control over their work sites. Here is the Industrial Rayon Corporation, which was a big minor American producer. So there was DuPont, there was the American Viscose Company, but there were some smaller places, and one of them was Industrial Rayon, based in Ohio. This is a nice artistic rendition of their Painesville, Ohio factory by the famous American photographer Margaret Burkwhite. This is in the collection of the Whitney Museum. But what about toxicity in the same time period, in the decade of the Depression? Well, in 1930, there was a major medical observation, which was that carbon disulfide, the key ingredient in viscose, was not only associated with insanity, not only associated with loss of nervous sensation, but in fact strongly related to Parkinsonism. And so the workers who survived the initial onslaught of toxicity went on to develop Parkinson's disease. By 1934, the United Kingdom government office put out a special memorandum on carbon disulfide dangers, not that they did much to control it. And by 1936, there was a report in the United Kingdom of nearly 1,600 cases of severe eye damage in the rayon industry. And that's because there's something about the interaction of carbon disulfide with that bath of sulfuric acid that produces yet another toxin, not characterized well to this day, that causes pretty severe eye damage. In 1938, the first big U.S. medical report came out in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Here's one of the few pictures that I've ever found of a rayon-intoxicated worker. This is a guy with a contraction of the hands consistent with an early manifestation of neurologic disease, and this is a worker in Turin in Italy that was one of the headquarters of the disease. And obviously this factory worker didn't normally wear a suit and tie, but he dressed up for this picture. And Gustavo Corelli was one of the first people, in fact, he was the first person to describe Parkinsonism. In the 1930s, finally, the Courtauld subsidiary that I mentioned before was making huge profits in the United States. In fact, most of the international profits were driven by that. DuPont, at the same time, founded what went on to become its most famous toxicological laboratories, the Haskell Labs. And this was in response to eye problems similar to the ones in Britain that had been reported in German rayon manufacturing. And of course, as you might imagine, DuPont was very close to the German manufacturers and exchanged a lot of information. And Industrial Rayon Corporation that I mentioned before was the site of one of the most important labor events of that period, the Covington, Virginia strike, which was a sit-down strike at a factory there. And finally, DuPont was very instrumental in the manufacture of cellophane. And you may wonder, why am I talking about cellophane? It's because cellophane is exactly the same thing as rayon. But instead of producing little threads, you put the viscose out through a thin slit into a bath of sulfuric acid, and that makes cellophane. Here's another one of the postcards from my collection. This is the Anka Rayon Company, which is a Dutch concern, but they had a factory in Asheville, North Carolina. In terms of toxicity and its study, one of the most important figures was an American physician named Alice Hamilton. She was really key in the study of rayon, but she was also key in occupational medicine in general, and was personally responsible for government action in this regard. And I want to read you something from her autobiography, which was published in the 1940s, in the early 1940s. For instance, I received a telegram back in the early 30s from an industrial nurse in a state which had practically no factory inspection service. She wired, "Epidemic of insanity has broken out in rayon plant. Doctors do not understand. Can you help?" I answered at once with a full description of carbon disulfide and an offer of my services. I also begged for more detailed information. No answer came to that or my other inquiries, for I wrote to the physicians and to the nearest insane asylum, so she wrote to see if there were cases. A veil of secrecy dropped and was never lifted, nor have I ever been allowed to visit that plant, even after all these years. Once I was on the verge of being admitted. It so happened that I sat next to the president of that company at a dinner in Washington and got from him a cordial invitation to visit the plant as soon as some alterations were completed. But when the time came, I received a formal, impersonal letter from the company saying that it adopted a policy of not admitting outsiders. This was after there had been some newspaper comments on an investigation of carbon disulfide poisoning in another state. Sounds a lot like the guy in 1880 saying, "I tried to find out information, and a veil of silence descended." But in fact, this is the telegram she received, which I tracked down in an archive in Connecticut. And there's some interesting things about it. First of all, it accurately describes what she says. But one of the things she left out is that the person who sent her the telegram was in fact not a nurse, but a Consumer League activist in Delaware. But the other thing is that it was Delaware, which she was very, very careful not to mention in her autobiography, because there was only one rayon factory in Delaware. And if she'd said Delaware, she would have been naming names, which is something that people didn't do in occupational medicine. Here's some stock. If you're so inclined, on eBay, you can also find stock of defunct rayon companies. And here's Alice Hamilton, who I've been talking about, in a postage stamp, since people don't use 55-cent postage stamps. It never really went very far. She carried out three studies of the rayon industry. The first was a pilot study in 1937 working with Bryn Mawr. She was very, very involved in Bryn Mawr, which was an extremely progressive women's college that did a lot of work in industrial health. Then she convinced the state of Pennsylvania to do a statewide study, and then, in fact, convinced the federal government to do a wider study. But it was only in Pennsylvania that workers were actually physically examined. Here, again, are the three studies. I want to highlight that first study wasn't physically done by Alice Hamilton. She got money for a young doctor named Dr. Adele Cohn to do the study. This is Adele Cohn as an intern prior to doing the study. I'd never heard of her. I thought, well, you know, I know a lot about occupational medicine. Who is this person? What happened to her? And through a lot of detective work, I found out that after she did this study, she went off to China during World War II to help the Chinese in Chongqing during the war, and then met a Brit and married him and moved to Britain, never came back to the United States, never did occupational medicine again. But I had the honor of meeting her grown son in London, and he provided me this picture. This is the American Viscose Company. Their flagship factory was in Marcus Hook, Pennsylvania. And in fact, all of the early rayon industry was in Pennsylvania, then moved south. And this is from Dr. Alice Hamilton's study. These are some of the real data from her study. This is in percentages of workers that they examined. They had to secretly take them off site and examine them because the company was trying to block what they were doing. And just to say that in terms of the neurologic findings, when they say irritability, they don't mean that you're in a bad mood. They mean that you have neurologic irritability, which was present in 70%, and that really 3 in 10 complained of hallucinations. So this is not trivial disease. And paranoia, which is a classic manifestation of carbon disulfide central nervous system toxicity, was present in almost 1 in 10 of these people. Now, during this period, perhaps not surprisingly, rayon began to take on somewhat sinister overtones. Here is a book that was published in 1932, Das Kunstzeichen Madchen, or the artificial silk girl is how it's usually translated. It was written by a writer named Kuhn, who the book was published in 32 and banned in 33 as being degenerate, but it tells the story of a young woman who moves to Berlin, becomes a kind of secretary, and she loves artificial silk, especially artificial silk underwear, which is made by a somewhat different process. It was only made into a film after the war. This is Giulietta Messina, actually, was the woman who played this in an international production. But just so you think it's not just European, here is the cover of a song cycle in Tamil. The best way to translate it is the courtesan guises, or colored imitation silk. So it uses imitation silk as a metaphor of being cheap or tawdry, because just like this is the same thing, but in Tamil. And here's a novel from 1942 called Agent in Italy, which is a novel about a German who escapes Germany to Italy because that's the only place he can go without a passport, and becomes a sales agent for Snia Viscosa, and is a kind of double agent giving the Allies data. This is the Time magazine book review at the time. I've read this thing. It's not so good, but anyway. And that perhaps the most interesting of this sort of genre is this 1942 storyboard image by Gertrude Elias, who is a an Austrian artist, refugee in England. She was a textile artist to start with. And she drew this storyboard to propose to the BBC an animated film that would be an anti-fascist animated film in which the sheep were the proletariat and the pigs were the fascists, and the pigs were trying to undermine the sheep by developing a synthetic fiber. And in fact, after the pigs' aggression, the sheep threw incendiaries and the artificial fibers burnt rapidly, ending with the pigs' defeat. Now, this animated feature was never made, but George Orwell saw these images and went on to be inspired. In contradistinction to the story of rayon as being cheap, cellophane became an icon of something else. It was frivolous. It was happy. It was wonderful. Here's just a bunch of selections. The cellophane wedding anniversary in Hollywood, which is supposed to mark your 6 months of being married together. And then of all of these, the most important, Macaulay started to move. I did not wait to see what he meant to do, but he slammed his chin with my left fist. The punch was all right, but I felt a burning sensation on my left and knew that I had torn the bullet wound open. "What do you want me to do?" I growled at Gil. "Put him in cellophane for you?" And that's the last line of The Thin Man from 1933. And, of course, this is the most important, arguably, artistic creation in the United States, avant-garde artistic creation in the 20th century, Gertrude Stein's Four Saints in Three Acts, with a choreography by Frederick Ashton, later Sir Frederick, score by Virgil Thompson. But the avant-garde scenery was made entirely of cellophane by a New York avant-garde artist named Florine Stettheimer. And the program for this production graciously acknowledges DuPont for providing the cellophane. And in music, If Love Came Wrapped in Cellophane, My Cellophane Baby, but most importantly, You're the National Gallery, Your Garbo Salary, Your Cellophane. So from Cole Porter's You're the Top. What about viscose as war materiel as the 30s transition into the 40s? Here's a nice image of the workers leaving the Snia Viscosa factory in Italy. And here's an advertisement from Snia Viscosa, talking about the textiles of the empire. This is around the time of the Abyssinian War, and you can see three different subtypes of their viscose fabric with the skeins of fabric and then the troops in the below. This is Torre Snia Viscosa in Milano. This was the tallest building, the first skyscraper in Italy. And I've sort of magnified where it says Snea Viscosa. Designed by a modernist architect in Milan who was Jewish and shortly after this was arrested and was deported but escaped en route and hid in Milan and continued to design buildings under a false name.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
In Japan, they had something called propaganda textiles, often made of silk, but some of the more important ones were made out of rayon because the rayon industry was so big. And in fact, children's kimonos was a favorite for this material. Here is some little propaganda from the United States. A Works Project Administration photographer named Jack Delano. But more important, this pamphlet from the American viscose company Rayon Goes to War, Happy Landing, showing the natives watching the airplanes come down with their rayon-reinforced tires. And in fact, rayon reinforcement was a big political fight because the cotton kings in the Senate, southern senators from cotton states, did not want rayon used in tires. They wanted cotton continued to be used. And the head of the rubber production board took on the southern senators, which was one of the first times that had ever happened. And that's what this political cartoon is about. In 1941, the U.S. forced Courtaulds to make American Viscose Corporation a publicly owned company, to sell it off. And that was our quid pro quo for Lend-Lease, which saved the British. The British were not very happy about this. And in fact, they sent Keynes to America to argue against this sale. But on the other side of the table was a guy named Harry Dexter White, who had done his doctoral thesis on tariff protections for the rayon industry. And so he didn't let them get away with this. And in fact, the only report that occurred contemporaneously with the war was a 1944 report of rayon toxicity in a Finnish rayon plant. The Finns had a lot of wood pulp, so they were big in it. This is that plant. And that plant was captured in South Karelia by the Russians. And here's a memo basically saying that they're going to use gulag labor to reopen this rayon factory as fast as they can. This was during the interim when they had captured South Karelia and before the Finns took it back, only to lose it at the end of the war. This memo is in, the microfilm of this memo is in Stanford because they've acquired all of the archives of the Central Committee, I guess. But it wasn't only the Russians that were into this stuff. Here's a OSS. Who knows what the OSS went on to become? CIA. This is an OSS memo that the Italians are rumored to be moving their factories from Italy to Spain, to Franco's Spain, to protect them from Allied bombing. Here's some other propaganda. Cellophane-wrapped rations was supposed to protect our workers as a magazine, advertisement by DuPont. And in the 1940s, probably the darkest period, rayon really became central to slave labor in Great Britain. Overexposure was also rampant in Italy and in occupied France. Here's a couple of images from books that are published much later, but about rayon in occupied France. And this guy, those of you who are in medicine will know Reiter's syndrome, which was a word for reactive arthritis and urinary tract problems. This is a little picture of Reiter. He was the Reich's Minister for Public Health and was quite concerned about rayon production and healthy Aryan workers, but not so concerned about non-Aryans. This is the Lenzing rayon plant in Austria, which was built in good timing just before the Anschluss. And here is Eric Sander, the son of the famous 20th century photographer August Sander. Eric died as a prisoner, but before he died, he worked in the Siegsburg infirmary of a prison that sent its prison labor to a nearby rayon factory, and he actually smuggled out letters describing the toxicity in these prisoners. And here's just a list. I won't dwell on it, but these are all concentration camp or slave labor manned rayon facilities across occupied Europe in various sites. And it does include some where it's really hard to get any residual data on. For example, this factory that was in Lodz and actually was a recycling plant for rayon. Here is the only extant photograph in operation of a concentration camp supplied rayon factory in Wittenberg, Germany. Here's a plant that was being built in occupied Norway in combination with a German Nazi regime. This is from 1943, but didn't open during the war. And here's perhaps the most famous concentration camp victim of rayon manufacturing, a man named Rukeli Trollmann, who was the German light middleweight champion in 1933, only to have the title stripped from him because he was a gypsy. And there's just been a movie made in Germany in the last couple of years about him. It's a tragic but fascinating story. And in fact, one of the things I stumbled across is this image of Jewish stars in the Deutsches Historische Museum. These are all made of rayon felt from rayon staple. So the slave labor making the rayon helped make the Jewish stars to put on other people. And here's the liberation of the satellite concentration camp from Mauthausen that helped serve Lenzing fibers in Austria. And obviously there's another soldier taking the photograph of the other soldier with the photograph. Immediately after the war, a lot of information started to emerge about these places from Belgium, from Italy, from France, from Poland, which in the Polish factory really, the conditions were so bad that many of the workers were sent off to mental institutions because of their insanity, never to be heard from again. And that factory that I showed you in Norway, it finally opened in 1948 and was a going concern until just a few years ago. But the most moving was this memoir that I recommend highly to any of you that want to read it. It's translated into English by Agnes Humbert. And she was arrested as an underground worker in France early in the occupation, sent to work in a factory in Germany. She didn't know actually what she was exposed to. She never mentions the word carbon disulfide in this book, but suffered terribly from the acid and from near blindness in this concern called Frick's. This is another aspect of the post-war production. This is one of Michelangelo Antonioni's first films, an industrial film called Six Canes and One Suit, about a factory that was built by SNEA even before the war and used as their source of cellulose reed canes from the water. And it shows the industrial process in very impressive detail, but then it ends with that last picture you see of a fashion show, really making the point that all of this is only to produce goods, luxury goods, with the surplus value of labor. Of course, the same thing was going on in the United States. Here's a nice picture from Mademoiselle of a pearly white rayon satin wedding dress, very stylish from the early 50s, 47, I guess it is. For $89.95, which is not so cheap. And many of you are familiar with flammable textiles, may think this is a problem with cotton. It was actually first reported with rayon, with a kind of rayon sweater where there was a lot of brushed rayon. These things caught fire so easily that they were called torch sweaters. And there's one of them burning there. The post-war marketing era was Of course, the time that the petroleum-based textiles emerged, nylon, then polyester. Nylon and rayon were a big competition in the tire industry. And rayon, during this time, became a big part of the economy in the Eastern Bloc, in the Soviet-controlled Eastern Bloc. Here's some of the tire competitions, rayon versus nylon. Nylon stretch is fine for bathing suits, but not for tires. So this is the side of nylon. This is the only town that's named after rayon. This is a town called Svit in Slovakia, which stands for the Slovenské viskozové továrny, the Slovak viscose works. It's still there, but doesn't produce rayon anymore. Meanwhile, rayon sort of held its own for a long time. Rayon staple compared to rayon fiber did relatively well, but there were some new and expanding markets, and one of them was for viscose-based sausage casings. So without viscose, we would not have skinless weenies. It's really necessary. And how many of you have a nice synthetic sponge in your kitchen? Maybe a 3M or Ocello, the older people may remember. That's all rayon. Here's some nice advertising for cellophane that I think wouldn't work so well anymore. Here's an image of the seamless rayon-based casings that are so important, and here's Ocello. But here is Spontex, which is huge in Europe, which is the same thing with their mascot is this hedgehog, and this was a pretty famous French commercial of the hedgehog having intercourse with the sponge. So very French. And Sweden is big into this. Wettex is the big Swedish brand. And this, as the time went on, we started to get technology transfer to other countries. Also, this was a time when it was realized that not only could carbon disulfide cause this insanity, not only could it cause Parkinson's disease, but long-term lower-level exposure caused stroke and heart disease. Here's a stamp from Cuba of a rayon factory that was built there, Rayonera. Here is Korea, where the Japanese rayon industry was exported and where they had such a massive outbreak of carbon disulfide neurologic disease that they had to build a special hospital for the victims. And then here's the first medical report of heart disease. It was done from Britain. The British Courtaulds really tried to suppress the study. And the work was done maybe 1961. It took a half a decade to get it published. For those of you with disco memories, you will remember perhaps Kiana, which is the nylon competitor for the silky artificial silk of rayon, but it never really took off very well. And here's the first rayon plant closures. This is what started to happen in Europe first and in America in 1970. This is an agitprop musical song related to that. But by 2015, actually, Frick's, this is the company that had the slave labor, it really only persisted in the name of a trendy club in Siegburg, which is where the prisoner I showed you worked in the camp. Night Out Siegburg, just the opposite of the big disco clang fabric. Yeah, you'll find the small and nice club Frick's. Prices are really okay, and the atmosphere is really great. I can only recommend to go there. This is from TripAdvisor, I think. And in Sweden, the big plants started to close down. This is Svenska Rayon that closed. The workers now maintain a museum there that I visited. And these are the chimneys starting to come down in Britain. I don't know why rayon factories have these huge chimneys, but they all do. They're classic. And so what are the new strategies? The new strategy is to market rayon as a green product. Why? Because it's cellulose. They sort of leave out the carbon disulfide. Wouldn't it be great if you could find sheets as soft as silk and as comfortable as cashmere that didn't heat up during the night? Thankfully, the best bamboo sheets do just that. So bamboo is the big part of this. But you can see here, this is a picture that my friend Marlene sent me, not woven from bamboo fiber, but from rayon viscose. So there's truth in advertising that's come into this. There's also high-tech rayon is part of, you know, NASA-based fabrics, and the R&D team in Bavaria is big into this. And if anybody buys Outlast, anybody here into this is like high-end sports type stuff, thermal stuff. That's rayon based. There's also uses of carbon disulfide, I should say, in pharmaceuticals. This is Anabuse, an alcohol aversion therapy, which in the human body is broken down to carbon disulfide. And why it's still on the market, I can't tell you, but it is. There's also pesticides that break down to carbon disulfide. This Enzone product, which now is banned in the United States, this is from an advertisement from Chile. I think it's even banned there now. Each molecule of Enzone gives 2 molecules of carbon disulfide. But carbon disulfide was used hugely in the 19th century. It was supposed to be the savior against the phylloxera epidemic, which wiped out the French wine industry. It actually didn't work, but it did expose a lot of people. It was also huge in the United States as a squirrel and gopher poison. Here's an advertisement from 1883. I like a lot. Death to squirrels and gophers. Here's a photograph even from the 1920s. I've blown up the bottle of carbon disulfide so you can see the label. What about, just drawing to a close here, what about the iconographic importance? Here's one use of cellophane as an icon from Frank O'Hara's poem, Second Avenue, Tabletops of Vienna, carrying their bundles of cellophane to the laundry. I have no idea what this means, and I've looked at a lot of criticism, poetry criticism. This is like a classic 20th century American poem by an important poet, but he's actually most famous for having really obscure and impenetrable lines, of which this is one, I would say. But easier to understand, Law and Order, Season 7, Episode 2. Jack McCoy, I thought he was going to ask you about your favorite sexual positions next. Jamie Ross, I grew up with 4 brothers. Marks is an amateur. This is Judge Marks, for those of you who are aficionados. You don't mind that kind of thing? Would you rather he ruled against us? I guess I have to unlearn some of my sensitivity training. If we have another hearing, you'll model silk for him again. Jamie Ross, trust me, he would have been just as big a fan of rayon. And this is a little sort of puff piece from Hemispheres magazine, which is a series read. Miami used to be all about rayon and tight dresses, very clubby. Now it's a bit hipper. And finally, this one. There's nothing I love more than a dumb blonde with daddy's plastic. Of course, Elle Woods knows that this is not what she's trying to sell her as last year's product. It's impossible to use a half-looped stitching on low viscosity rayon, etc. Here's that wedding dress I showed you from Mademoiselle. Here is the mother of a friend of mine being married in that dress, and here she is being married in the dress in the middle, and her daughter trying it on, who refused to wear it at her wedding. One of the people in our audience used to work at this factory at the National Rayon Company outside of Mumbai. This is a picture of that, and this is a picture of the internal works where they actually made their own carbon disulfide. It's from Ambivalent, which sounds a little bit like ambivalent to me, but it's been closed in a lockout since 2009. It's basically a real estate deal. And this, that just came out in 2017, in June, a couple of months ago, is a muckraking report on all of the rayon industry, which has moved to China and Indonesia and India, and the pollution associated with it. And here's starting to come out some scientific studies. These are sperm abnormalities in Chinese workers, for example, related to carbon disulfide exposure, published in 2016. Here's the old American Viscose factory from Front Royal, Virginia, closed in 1989, now an EPA's Superfund site. But here next to it is Viscose, King of Viscose Lensing Fabrics from Austria, the one that I mentioned before with their new factory in Nanjing, China. Here's the former British Cellophane, closed down. But Inovia Films in Tecumseh, Kansas, which was a UK-based corporation and now has just recently been taken over by Futamura Chemical in Japan in 2016. It's still one of the largest cellophane companies in the world. So in conclusion, carbon disulfide has clearly been known to be an industrial hazard for more than 150 years, but the failure is not in failing to recognize it, it's failure to do something about it. And it's always new technologies and new applications that drive new sources of exposure. And I think the viscose industry, important in its own right, is also a paradigm for what happens when you put profits before people. And unfortunately, that's not unique. So thank you very much for your time. Okay. And attention.
Well, we have questions now. Thank you. So, Dr. Blanc, did the factories ever install equipment to protect workers from carbon disulfide?
Eventually, the factories in Europe, and for example, the Lenzing factory, which I visited, which is still in operation in Austria, has installed an enclosed system, and it actually pays for itself because you recapture all that carbon disulfide and then you use it again. I don't think the motivation was ever so much to protect the workers. In fact, when I was taken around the factory, I was taken up not their smokestack, but their kind of silo where they would store stuff by an older worker who now can't work on the line, so he kind of takes people around and does stuff. And we went up to the top of this thing, and we looked out over the factory grounds, and he said, "Yeah, our last suicide from here was in the 1950s. But, of course, during the war, there were a lot more."
Okay. If I enter a shop and want to buy a blouse, how do I know there is no carbon disulfide in it?
Well, there isn't going to be carbon disulfide in it because it all went into the worker's atmosphere. But if you want to know how do you know if there's rayon in it, if it says viscose, like 20% viscose, viscose is rayon, if you want to know. But the real issue is the people who make it. It's not, you don't have to throw out your rayon in your closet.
Okay. What are today's most egregious consumer products with unregulated or unacknowledged occupational hazards in its manufacture?
Well, that's a kind of a big question that I don't know if I can. I think, let me come at it from a different direction. I think the issue is that if something is not hazardous to the consumers who buy it, really nobody pays attention. It's a kind of what me worry sort of approach to things. And it's actually the moral equivalent. If you buy a T-shirt at Walmart and you buy it because it's, you know, $5 cheaper, but somebody worked in a ninth-story walk-up death trap in Bangladesh to make it, mm-hmm. What is your responsibility as a consumer? It's not a hazard to you just because it was made that way. So that's really the big issue.
Okay. Were the physicians who saw the early cases of acute carbon disulfide poisoning employed by the manufacturers?
Some were, but most weren't, I would say. I don't think it was the issue that the physicians saw it. The physicians reported it, but then it sort of went nowhere.
Okay. I'm having a hard time with the handwriting. Modal have any?
So Modal is a, there are a couple of products that are made by Lenzing Fibers, and one of them uses an alternative carbon disulfide. It's a process that they actually bought from a subsidiary of Cortals before Cortals went out of business. So that one process is a non-carbon disulfide-based rayon. Unfortunately, there's very little data on that chemical that's used as an alternative, although I will say it's hard to imagine that any chemical could be as problem-ridden as carbon disulfide. There's also another kind of non-carbon disulfide-based rayon, which is called cupro. It's cupro-ammonium silk, and it is the preferred rayon for the linings of very, very expensive bespoke suits. And so if you're an aficionado of $5,000 or $10,000 suits, you're going to have cupro linings.
Okay. Again, I apologize for not being able to read this handwriting very well. What about sulfuric acid?
What about sulfuric acid? Can't caustic soda and other, other components in this process. So the sulfuric acid, as I mentioned, combines with the carbon disulfide to create new chemicals that are really the source of the eye problem. Caustic soda, although it's a problem, a skin problem, because it's very, very basic caustic material, was never the main problem in the rayon industry, I would say, historically.
Okay.
And it's not very volatile, so that's another. But one of the big issues with carbon disulfide is that it off-gases so easily. In fact, carbon disulfide was used in the early 19th century after its use in rubber and before its use in rayon as an anesthetic. It was one of the early experimental anesthetics, and the person who did the research on it was Jon Snow, not from Game of Thrones. Jon Snow, the early anesthesiologist who also was responsible for identifying the Broad Street pump as the source of cholera in the London epidemic. And he tried it on people and rejected it immediately because of its toxicity.
Okay. Well, our many thanks to Dr. Blanc for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as for those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating the 114th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. That was awesome.